Welcome, everyone, to episode 11 of the Final Boss Blues podcast. And today we are going to discuss something very interesting. But before we do that, I am Reynard Frost, and I'm going to introduce my co-hosts, Despain.
I'm not really here right now.
And Killam.
I am here right now.
Today, we're going to... Wait, I forgot. What time is it?
No. We're doing a different joke.
A different joke? Well, yeah. I went to a girl's place, and she decided to teach me something called a player play.
That's even worse.
Okay, that, all right, that
today,
worked. Right,
cool. Today we're going to be looking at The Last Werewolf by a guy named Jank, in caps. As always, you can find this in the project development forum on RPG Maker Web. So, Reynard, do you want to kick us off and start off by reading the first couple paragraphs here? He has like a whole poem thing that... we're not going to be going into in detail, but
I could sing this.
I don't want to listen to you sing this in
Spanish. Oh, you do want to listen to me. Anyways, all right. So here's The Last Werewolf by Jank.
Jank.
Okay. The Last Werewolf is a story of a young hunter named Archer and the struggles that he faces both inwardly and outwardly. Through his journey, he discovers that he has hidden powers, which leads to a life of hardship and a heavy responsibility that he is not prepared to face. Archer must choose his path, whether or not he will use his powers for good or for evil. In this story, the iconic werewolf takes center stage. According to legend, the werewolf is a powerful and ferocious hybrid between a man and a kobold, a legendary creature that only comes along once every 1,000 years. No one knows for sure where they come from. The most famous werewolf legend is the legend of King Darius the Great.
In ancient times, the world was at war with itself and the many races all
I'm not doing that.
No, all right, this is too long, and I just want to say this is not the story of the iconic werewolf. This is the story he made up for werewolves, because werewolves are not a fusion of humans and kobolds. Those are called half-bloods or something else.
You know, if he uses that as his backstory for the werewolf...
No, that's fine.
But as long as...
Iconic werewolf story. You don't say... the iconic werewolf, and then come up with a new story. You just go, in this, werewolves are this. And then you go, oh, okay, that's his interpretation of werewolves.
Yeah, but what I'm saying if he keeps that as his backstory, as them being a hybrid or whatever, if he keeps the same basic idea that the werewolf is a man that can turn into a wolf, like, that's what a werewolf is to me. Like, he has two forms.
It's like, it's just saying it's a powerful and ferocious hybrid between a man and a kobold.
Yeah,
so
that's not a werewolf to me. A werewolf is somebody who changes between being a man and being a wolf man.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. You turn from human to humanoid wolf creature. If you're just both, then you're a beast man.
Exactly. It's the whole idea of transformation is what makes a werewolf a werewolf.
Yeah, you're a half, like, and you're not a were-orc. If your mom's a human and your dad's an orc, you're a half orc.
You're a were orc if you turn into an orc.
Yeah, exactly.
Or if you skin them and wear them on your head.
Yeah, no.
Get it,
then
get
you
it,
just
get it. Then you're
really,
then you're wearing
really
an orc,
exotic headgear. but yeah, no. This is the story about a half kobold. He also calls them kobolds. I find that interesting.
Plural. There's only one every 1,000 years.
There's only one every thousand. Where did?
Only one hybrid every 1,000 years.
Okay.
Let's see here. So characters, he's got. So his main characters are humans.
His main characters are also recognizable Kaduki characters.
Yes, they're Kaduki characters,
which we've all seen 1,000 times before, and we have ranted about that in previous podcasts. So I will do my best to ignore it.
He also has a race called Nekojin.
Which is just essentially anime cat characters.
Yeah, it's
it looks
Japanese
like Inuyasha.
It's Japanese for cat person.
It's Inuyasha, the face.
Yeah, pretty much. And he's got a kobold.
And we have
elves,
rolling on the floor laughing.
Forest spirits and a harpy, which class not sure yet. So he's got a character he hasn't designed.
That's
he
not
just
a
knows,
harpy.
Man,
that's
this
just,
crow face set looks
that's just
awesome.
A
and that's not a harpy.
That's just a raven. Harpies are humans. They have human faces with wings and legs.
Yeah. It's bird body, human torso. So you got tits, belly, and head and shoulders of a human woman. And then you've got bird wings and bird legs and crotch.
Yeah, he's got the harpy backwards.
Yeah. This harpy is backwards. This is a birdman. So you've got some definitions that are – you're using some names that are not – exactly lined up with the popular accepted definitions of these things.
I mean, like, so. I'm all with switching around what the classic races are, but at the same time, you can't deviate too much from it and still use the name.
Yeah.
Or else you risk a disconnect with the player's understanding of your game world.
Exactly, because then you've got people like us looking and going, but no, that's not what it is. That's like, you know, that's like saying vampires sparkle in sunlight.
It's terrible. You know, there was actually a reason for that. In her backstory for the vampires, it was because they were sparkling to attract their human prey. It wasn't just because they were, I mean...
All I'm saying is if you are an eternally youthful young man that sparkles in the woods and doesn't drink blood, you're a fairy, not a vampire.
You know...
By all definitions, you are a fairy. All right. Anyways...
You know, we haven't debated enough about Twilight on this podcast for our listeners.
Nope, and we're not going to, and we are not going to.
believe it or not, I am actually a big Twilight fan.
You are a liar.
I'm not. Have you seen my... I wrote an article that dissects the story of New Moon.
No, I haven't. And I'm going to talk about screenshots in this player.
All right, let's talk about screenshots.
Taste in books is definitely a player, right?
No. You haven't. You haven't beat Chrono Trigger, but you read Twilight. I just want to throw it out there, guys. Just want to throw that out there.
We can't be friends.
Let's talk about screenshots.
So the screenshots. His maps are very wide. The world maps. This world map he's got, where he's walking to a village, it's at 75% goodness, but it could use some work. It's, I don't know, it doesn't look natural. The shapes are very just...
The whole thing with these maps is that they're very, very wide open.
Yeah, they're
and
empty.
I see this problem all the time. People are like, you know, well, my maps are open, but if I don't want to crowd them too much, then make them smaller. There's nothing wrong with having small, direct maps. We've talked about it in our level design episode. Just,
exactly.
You know, give the player a clear way to go. You don't want so much just plain green or plain brown. You don't want such a... You don't want to fill the screen with texture. You want to fill the screen with the world. I hope that makes sense.
Well, I do like the mountain thing where he's got the river here. I mean, it's very brown, sure. He could use a couple dead trees or something. But it's got a good space and layout.
Yeah, in my opinion. It works.
The forest, this little grassy one, is very sparse and not very well done. And the cottage one he's got, my complaint with this one is he's got these logs that are in a kind of M pattern. You don't want any kind of pattern with nature type stuff. It's when you're doing nature stuff, it's nature is random. Not so much a planned thing. And his houses, the thing is people when they make these houses, they're thinking in the proportions of it's like, oh, well, this table's got to have – it's got to be in the middle and there has to be this much space in the walls. Instead of thinking, if I were this size, if my person was one pixel wide, how big would this room be?
Yeah, what I was saying about people making their maps too big, that primarily applies to houses. We see so many houses that people feel the need to fill up the entire screen, and there's no need for that at all. If it's a small interior, it's an NPC house or something, just don't be afraid to make it a small area where you can just walk in. It doesn't even have to take up the whole space.
Yeah,
exactly. Just one, like a dining room and a bed is all you need.
It looks better, and the player doesn't feel like he's wasting his time wandering around in this area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's also put together a crude fishing minigame a la... Trying to do it with Breath of Fire. He's got some Breath of Fire fish sprites chilling in there. So
where? You see them?
It's in the fishing pics beneath the other screenshots.
Oh, there we go. Spoiler.
So I don't know if we really need to see three screenshots for this, but I mean, I guess he's really proud of it, so good for
him. He's trying to show the gameplay. He's like, look, I did what's in Breath of Fire 3, and...
I've never played it, so...
You just...
Yeah, I mean, if he did event this by himself, and that is a pretty big accomplishment, so he should probably showcase it.
Yeah.
Good for him, whatever.
So his game features are basically from Breath of Fire 3, Breath of Fire 2, Breath of Fire 3, Breath of Fire 2, Breath of Fire 3.
Oh, that hunting minigame, that must have been that wide forest screenshot we saw before.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's like
that,
a deer.
Then that does make sense then. But still, it's still a little sparse.
No, but the hunting minigame in Breath of Fire 2, the maps weren't huge and wide when they were doing the hunting. You just... saw a critter and you chased after it.
Yeah.
Anyways, this has been the last half kobold by Jank. You can find this on the RPG Maker.
I want to note that he says in his user title, it says music composer. I would really like if he had like some music samples. Not that I'm the biggest music person at all, but if you are a music composer and one of the big draws of your game is music, put some samples or something in your thread, because that can really interest a lot of people.
Indeed. Indubitably.
I mean, he doesn't really mention anything about music in his topic at all, but his user title does say music composer, so if that's your ability, you should play it up and work to your strengths.
So, before we go into our verdicts, what are some ways that this project could be made better, Despain?
Well, the big thing, like I said, the maps, they just don't really have anything special, you know? They're not great, they're not terrible, but there's nothing about them that makes me want to play this game at all. They just look like somebody opened our RPG Maker and slapped some maps together. I mean,
okay, Killam, what about you?
For me, my big gripe is the lack of presentable features. Like, he has a features list, and I'm interested with about the Master System. Like, that one looks down, that sounds great, but they're not shown in the screenshots. I don't have any concrete evidence to see if they're good or not. All we have is maps. There's no gameplay footage. Just
we don't
people
see any
walking
battle
around.
System.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing is what? Yeah, first off, he doesn't have these systems planned out. It looks like, so that's why he doesn't have screenshots on it. But he's just listing as in, I'm using this system from this game. And when you're inspired from a game, that doesn't mean I'm using their gameplay features and throwing on a new story. That's not inspired by. That is basically just ripping their gameplay features. So the Master System is basically there are NPCs littered about the world, and when you talk to them, you can assign a party member to that master. And while you're traveling around, you level up that character. Once you reach a certain amount of levels, you go back to that NPC, and they'll go, oh, congratulations, let me give you a skill. And if you've played Breath of Fire 3, you understand that. But if you haven't played Breath of Fire 3, like you guys, you'll have no idea what he's talking about. So I agree that he should definitely be... at least.
Yeah, he should talk about the game as if it were his own game.
Yeah.
Because it is. He's not treating it like his own game.
Well, he says it right in his intro. He says, as stated in the title, this project takes heavy inspiration from the Breath of Fire series. So
but
you see
does
a
that
lot of
mean
similarities.
It's a fan game? Does that mean he's there's a
no,
difference between being
his,
a fan
he,
game
what he's done is he's
inspired.
Taken Breath of Fire gameplay
and
put
features.
His own story on it. That's what he said. That's what he means by inspired by Breath of Fire. He's like, I'm gonna take Breath of Fire gameplay and put my own story in it.
It might as well just be a fan game then, because the Final Fantasy series, they all have different stories and settings.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't have like dragon transformation and stuff. But either way, you need to try and make the gameplay. You need to try and make it a way so it stands on its own. If I want to play Breath of Fire gameplay, I'm going to play Breath of Fire because it's made by professionals.
Which I will do. Soon, because I want to play Breath of Fire 3 again.
Yes, it's a good game. But yeah, the thing is where you don't want to allude your game to a popular franchise, because then people are going to go, well, if your game is like Breath of Fire and you have nothing new for me, I'm going to go actually play Breath of Fire, because it's a brand I trust and I know I can get a good experience. When you're trying to make a topic like this and you're trying to get people to play your game or be interested in your game, you have to put forth something that makes it unique. I mean, you can have these gameplay features from Breath of Fire, but you need to stop associating it so much with Breath of Fire and try and tweak the gameplay elements or try and mix and match them in a way where it's not so much, oh, I'm playing a game that's just like Breath of Fire, but instead, I'm playing The Last Werewolf.
Yeah, like we always talk about giving your game its own identity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't want people to play your game and go, oh, it's like this. You want people to play your game and go, oh, it's I can see some things that may be drawn from it, but that's inevitable. This game is like your game. But anyways, now for final verdicts on this. Killam, what's your thoughts?
I am going to have to give this a flay. Not out of spite. I don't really find anything I dislike, but the problem is I don't really see anything at all. There's no gameplay footage. I don't know what the gameplay is. There's no battle systems. There's really nothing I can go on to actually have a concrete verdict, so I'm going to have to give this a flay based on that.
Despain, what about you?
Yeah, flay. It's just, the whole thing just looks bland. It just looks like a very generic, you know, kid's first RPG Maker game. So, I mean, good for him if it is. I mean, I look forward to seeing more from him in the future as he gets a little better. But there's just nothing there at all that makes me want to play this game.
I'll have to agree with Afflay, just because there's nothing standing out, and he's relying too heavily on Breath of Fire as a crutch. So I will also have to give this Afflay. So there you have it. This is The Last Werewolf by Jank. Unanimous Afflay across the board. So with that, let's move on to our main topic. Kill him.
All right, guys. This is an interesting topic for today because
it is not interesting at all.
Yes, it is. Every single game ever made in RPG Maker game has this, and I'm sure you guys all know it. They're cliches. And what is a cliche? If you got one of you wanted to define it.
A cliche, as far as I define it, I don't have a Webster's open or anything, but a cliche is basically a story element or anything really that is commonly used to a point where it ascends to the cliche level.
You can't use the word to define itself, bro.
I know I can't. Hold on. Let me get a definition. Kill him down.
You don't need a dictionary. A cliche is something that's been used so many times there's no originality to it anymore. It's something that it's used so often that it's expected, and it's expected in a way where it takes away from the story, where you're getting less enjoyment.
Perfect definition right here. It is an expression, idea, or element of an artistic work which has been overused to the point of losing its original meaning or effect, especially when at some earlier time it was considered meaningful or novel.
Yeah, which is pretty much what we just said, but in more technical terms,
yeah, exactly.
I suppose.
Yes, put it in clear and concise terms.
Well, for me, cliches aren't as bad as that definition went on to be, as in it's unoriginal.
I don't think anybody's saying they're bad. I mean, we always have topics in the forums about, you know, cliches are bad, are they bad or not? And the intelligent people, the best worded posts, always say they're not always bad. It depends on how you use them.
Yeah, exactly.
A cliche is basically, it's something that's overused to a point where it loses its original meaning. So your challenge with using something that has become a cliche is to try and instill that meaning it once had. So you want to make changes to it so it can have meaning again.
You want to personalize it. You want to make it really a part of your story so it's not just something that people have seen before.
Exactly. So, but yeah, so basically that's the one thing with making a cliche work is you want to try and give the cliche meaning again. You want to try and at least somehow make it novel, whether it's a character who wakes up with amnesia, which is often used as a cliche in RPGs because you want to make the protagonist know as little about the world they're jumping into as the player. So, I mean, you can do this by where instead of starting off with having amnesia, you can have it where the character knows what's going on, but he doesn't say what's going on, and then you witness the event that gives him amnesia, and then you get to find out and piece stuff together. I mean, those are little changes you can make to make amnesia work. And there's other cliche elements you can make work, but the main thing you want to do when you're trying to make a cliche fit in your game is you want to try and make sure it has meaning in your story. You want to make sure it fits. You don't want somebody to jump in and go, oh, I'm a 14-year-old kid with spiky hair. Oh, my God, Japan. It's, you know, maybe he was electrocuted as a kid, or maybe it's just the hairstyles.
He has anime hair because he was electrocuted as a kid and it never went away.
Exactly. So you know, that's how he got his anime hair. He was electrocuted. And he just hasn't found a body of water or shampoo yet to fix it. So or you know, there's so many cliches to work from. But yeah, the main thing you want to worry about is as I've said for the third and final time is just add meaning to it. So, you know, whether you've got your parents are dead, you want to, instead of just going the parent grows up as an orphan, you want to actually show the player how their parents died and make their death meaningful to the story instead of just a convenient device to free the player from responsibility. So it's not better come home. I mean, or just, I mean, if you really want to swap it on its head, keep the parents alive and find a means that doesn't involve killing them to make it so they accept the fact that you leave. And don't make it just go, oh, well, it's your time to go on an adventure, Billy, so have fun.
Like, yeah, maybe his dad's an alcoholic and just doesn't even care or notice, and that's pretty. That can add a dramatic element to it.
Exactly, stuff like that you can add. I mean, the reason why a lot of cliches get used is just to either for gameplay or just to get the story started. So you want to try and find a way to get it so your player goes from his safe bubble to adventure. In a new way, or if you're going to rely on a cliche, just twist it slightly. Like Despain was saying, if you want to go brand new, make it so the father's an alcoholic, where you know he doesn't care, or that he's abusive, and the player has to run, has to flee from this. So you can do a broken home. It doesn't exact. So kill him. What are some examples of some cliches that are widely used?
Well, first of all, let me just say the worst part of a cliche is when you use it as an excuse plot, as in you throw it in there because you're lazy and you don't actually put effort into your game. For example, crystals, not just crystals, they could be plot items. They're there just to progress the story in most games. Yeah, exactly. They're like, when you think about it, think about your game and why there are crystals in it. Do they have a purpose? Are they actually important besides them being...
They keep the world running because in my world, they're run by crystals. And if the crystals stop working, the world falls apart because you know what? When I'm a god and I'm designing a planet, I want it to be used by an easily malleable source so the denizens can fuck up their own shit.
Yeah, I really need a reason to get my character, my main character to go to 7 different temples with different elemental themes.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a good example because it's prevalent in so many games and it is the easiest thing to use to explore other areas of the world is you have to visit these temples for crystals or whatever.
Yeah.
It's
not so much crystals, it's just ancient items. It's, oh, you have to find the 7 crystals or you have to find the 3 pendants of power, Zelda, or you have to find 7 shards of Narsil, Lord of the Rings. It's, you know, it's... You have to find a bunch. Something powerful was broken into pieces, or there's all these nodes that you have to go and light up again. And it's their gameplay. Those are kind of to me a necessary evil because you need those to progress the gameplay.
You don't always.
How else are you going to get it besides just... I mean, an alternative you could have is you've just got the villain going, "Catch me if you can," and he runs to the next temple.
Basically.
Yeah.
No, but I agree. Like, they're key items, not just crystals, key items. You kind of do need them in a game, but they're not going to be necessarily crystals, and they won't be that prevalent, but you're gonna have something akin to them.
I guess the thing to do that is to make to put enough explanation and forethought into these items you have to collect where the player actually cares about collecting them beyond just, oh, well, RPGs.
Or you don't always have to collect items. I mean, there's so much opportunity to create dungeons where the goal isn't just to get something and get out. Like, if your story is dynamic enough, if your world is deep enough, you can have each dungeon have a really unique purpose to the plot. The character doesn't have to be going to each dungeon to collect something.
Final Fantasy 13.
You can have it be a little more progression based.
No, that's what Final Fantasy 13 did. They had a long string of dungeons, and although people criticize it for being very linear, you weren't in those dungeon/areas to pick up an item and go. You're just, this is where the story is taking you. To me,
That game was
strictly just one long dungeon crawl.
And I like that. That sounds pretty cool.
I liked it a lot, yeah. It was basically, all right, you're in this futuristic city, and then you're in this neighborhood, and then you're in this cavern system, and then you're in these sewers, and then you're on this train, and then you're finally in this wide world, and then you're in this and this. But the dungeon progression wasn't so much, you have to go to the fire temple to pick up the fire crystals so you can use it to save the volcano from erupting and save the village and poor Billy. Goddamn Billy. He's the one who fucked up the crystal in the first place. Him and his buddies went to go pick it up, and they peed on it for a dare, and they just fucked up all of creation. Yeah, to me, that's one of the merits of Final Fantasy XIII, is they had really good dungeon progression. You were going from point A to point B because it was just where the story was taking you. It wasn't so much, go there and pick up a crystal.
Yeah, A Blurred Line did that too. The really popular old RPG Maker 2000 game. And it had a great storyline, and all of the dungeons have their own relevance to the story. I mean, some of them were kind of lame, like you just go into the sewers to escape a bad guy or whatever, and stuff like that. But none of them really felt like they were just sort of forced into the world where you had to go to each one and collect as an excuse to explore the world. Every dungeon that you went through, you were just put there by the progression of the story, and you just continued going, and it had its own purpose, their own unique purpose. None of the dungeons were really just there to be a dungeon.
So,
what else you got, Caleb?
Any other masks?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole list. All right. The stereotypical evil empire. My big beef with this one is that no one ever asks why. Like, why are they evil? They're evil just because they're evil. What if the main character is actually evil and he's fighting a good empire? It's never really explored in depth. And
No, they make it pretty apparent why they're evil. Because they start punking out the villagers, or they're invading other cities, or
their chief representative wears a lot of creepy makeup.
Yeah. Like, I don't see
if an empire invades other cities, that isn't always a bad thing. I mean, look at the Roman Empire. It was glorious. I mean, it did lots of horrible things, in its quest to become the greatest. But, I mean, world domination on its own isn't necessarily an evil goal.
Well, look at Final Fantasy IV, where you've got Baron basically invading towns to pick up their crystals and killing people needlessly.
That's the crystals that drives people to be evil.
Just go into ransack shit. And that was a way to show that the Empire was slowly becoming evil. And I also liked how they were saying, well, we weren't always evil, but the king's gone on a bender and something's weird.
You know, I think the entire concept of evil is a cliche in itself. Take that.
Well, that's pretty deep, dude. I don't know how you're going to back that up.
Well, I see where you're coming from, though. I mean, I like, as a player, the idea of fighting evil, because it's basically lets me do all this crazy stuff, but I know I'm doing it against a dark force, so I feel guilty about it. But there is a way where you can make it, so it's not so much that instead of going good versus evil, it's protagonist versus antagonist. So
you've got
people with two separate sets of values.
Yes.
I mean, your antagonist is not exactly evil. Your antagonist just has an opposing view from you, so you're going to butt heads.
Yeah, every single person has their own view of what they're doing as good. The bad guy thinks he's a hero in his eyes, and the good guy thinks he's a hero. It's protagonist versus antagonist again.
That's what makes some of the best villains.
Yeah, exactly.
Villain who you can relate to. Who the villain isn't doing something necessarily because it's to be evil. The villain is doing it because they feel this is their best course. This is their best thing to do. And even if it's something, even if it's a wicked act they're performing, like they're lashing out at people and enslaving people or hurting people, they do it because they feel that it is just. They're like, these people wronged me at one point. Even if they're misguided, the villain should always be someone you can relate to. Where if you know the villain's backstory and they're doing all these bad things, as a player, you sit there and go, you know what? I could see why somebody would do that. And so instead of hating the villain, you're just kind of like, I have to stop them because what they're doing is wrong, but I don't hate the villain because they're trying to do the right thing, so maybe I can try and work something around instead of just trying to kill them outright. Not to be said that there's sometimes it's fun to have a villain who you just hate and you love to hate them and you just want to make them suffer, Joffrey. So
I like Joffrey. He's pretty cool.
I hate Joffrey. He's a little cunt.
If I was in his position, I would probably be a lot like him, to be honest.
Oh, God.
Well, I mean, think about the way he was raised. He was raised with a certain sense of entitlement. I mean, you can't really blame him for being who he is.
No, he was a sick and twisted puppy. There's entitlement, and then there's just straight-up sadism.
Yeah.
Joffrey's the sadist.
And when you put them together, you get an awesome fucking character.
Well, yeah, no, he was a great villain because he was a sadist, but he also felt entitled. He didn't feel he was doing anything wrong. He's just, I'm the king. I can do whatever I want.
Exactly.
Only says I'm special. And I apologize to everyone listening that I am just atrocious to listen to right now because, you know, the illness, the plague, it has infected everyone.
Yep. Except for me too.
But anyways, so Caleb,
let's move on then. All right. The dead parent cliche or no parent cliche. Why? Don't use it. If you don't want to have your parents mentioned, just don't mention them.
We just talked about how it could work, how you could change.
I know, but like, you don't necessarily have to just put it in there. Like, oh, my parents are dead, by the way. Like, well, just don't talk about it.
Yeah. And that leads me into one of the ones that I was going to talk about, how the main character is always like 14, 15, 16 years old. Please don't do that, because most of the time, in these games with the young characters, he's also a master swordsman, or he's the leader of a rebel alliance, or you know, he's a captain of the guard, and he's, you know, 16 years old, and he's, you know, a magical guru, and it's just ridiculous.
Not at 16. I mean, yeah, people in a fantasy genre, people start off stuff very young because your life expectancy is about 50, but you don't start off as, like, Master of the Guard. Like, Captain of the Guard is 24, not 16. 16, you're, like, recruit. you might have, like, a year of experience under your belt. But not like, I'm the Captain of the Guard and I'm Master Swordsman. It's like, no, that you need a decade. You would need to be, like, late 20s. Just 10 years of fucking with swordsmanship.
It's not like
I picked up a sword when I was 5.
And there's nothing wrong with having an older protagonist.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard for a lot of RPG maker users to write because they might not have that age or experience under their belt. But in a good story, the age of their protagonist, it doesn't have to be a little kid. I mean, you can go into a lot of depth, and I would definitely make the point that older characters, there is certainly a lot more potential for depth in their personalities if they're well-written.
I agree, but at the same time, you have to consider your whoever's going to play your game, can they really relate to an older character? Because what's your definition of old?
If he's well-written, yes.
What's your definition of old?
Well, comparing to RPG Maker users, make him older than 25. Make him an adult. He lives on his own. He has a job. He supports himself.
No, I'm fine with early 20s.
Yeah.
You'd have a character. Like, if you want to go with the young recruit, like, just starting out, level 1 character, you can make him early 20s or even 18 or 19. But if you're having a guy who's like, oh, I'm a seasoned soldier or, you know, I'm a master magician, yeah, they got to be, like, late. They got to be over 25.
Well, the idea I'm getting at here is that there's a difference between a kid and an adult. The age, totally irrelevant. It's more about his position in life. Does he live with his parents or does he have a job? Does he have a girlfriend? Does he have a wife? Does he have children of his own? These are the kind of things that I look at. I don't care about the number of his age. I care about where he is in his life's progression. And that is a huge difference between your characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree then. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Kill him, master of... No. Let me rationally explain it. Oh, yeah, I agree. Sorry.
No, because I was correlating it to actual number age.
No. I get where you're coming from. You do that a lot, and I find it funny.
Well, that's because he has a good argument.
No, he does. And we're not disputing that. But moving on, you got anything else on your plate, or should we move on to another subject?
Well, I have one more that ties in a lot to how to actually write out a cliche, so it's pretty good, actually. The ancient civilizations cliche. I really, really tried to avoid it in my game because it's used in every single game, but I just couldn't really do it. It's really hard to avoid.
Hey, someone has to make all those temples, right?
Yeah, exactly. But not even, like, just anything. Like, any sort of ancient structure has to have a reason to be there. But, like, I really, really didn't want to use it again, but I had to use it. But the difference between using it is making it actually work and making it not work, obviously. You have to plan out your lore, basically. Personalize it for your game. You can't just say, oh, there's a temple here because an ancient civilization built it. Why they built it? Why is there a temple here? You have to ask these questions to the audience.
A good example of ancient civilization being used was Final Fantasy X.
Metroid Prime,
yeah, it was also a good example. But I think Final Fantasy X was a good use of ancient civilization. Because you start off as a member of that ancient civilization, and then you're, like, however many years in the future, in the present, as, you know, spoilers, a ghost of that civilization. So, I thought that was cool. So you have all these ancient temples, and they're like, what is this? Well, this used to be where I lived, and it's wrecked. What happened? Sin? But yeah, no, Metroid Prime also does a lot of ancient civilization stuff.
Metroid Prime keeps a lot of mystery in it while still giving them depth.
Yeah.
It's a really good balance that Metroid Prime is able to strike with the Chozo.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like an excuse plot with that, with the Chozo. You're just like, okay, yeah, there's this ancient civilization, but that's also a lot of visual and level layout design.
Absolutely,
that
yeah. And it works because it's the whole destroyed planet.
Yeah. So that's just the setting you're in, and there's bits and pieces about it. And since there's such a mystery, you want to know more. So I guess that's the balance between it when you're using an ancient civilization cliche is you want if the player wants to know more about this ancient civilization, you're doing it right. If they don't care and they're just like, RPGs, then you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, what you said, actually, the excuse plot is a perfect example and definition of really the whole cliche thing. Like, you have to, like you said again, the player has to care about the civilizations. Map out all of your lore, even if the player will never read it, just so you have that backing for it.
That's no, as a disclaimer, excuse plots are fine for beginning projects. If you just want to, if you're just trying to make games and develop skills, and you're trying to make a little quick game, an excuse plot is perfectly fine. But if you're trying to make a game that you want to appeal to a wide audience and you want to, you know, be popular, then yes, you want to plan out some stuff. You don't need to plan out every single aspect of your lore, but you want to ask yourself some key questions and be able to answer those questions. So, you know, you don't need to write an Encyclopedia Britannica of the universe of your game.
Those are fun to write, though.
Yeah, they are fun to write, but
I had so much fun with my game in that. Oh, my God.
They're fun to write, but when you're writing that, you're not getting your game making done. So, basically, what I do is whatever part of a game I'm in, whatever the player is exposed to, I try and think of questions they might ask, and then I come up with answers for that. And I make sure the answers are either available in the game, or they can get those answers somewhere, or I just appreciate the fact that they're asking this question, and it progresses them further into the game. But you want to find that fine balance between getting your game done and writing an encyclopedia. Because when you're writing an encyclopedia, you're pretty much becoming Tolkien, because Lord of the Rings was basically his excuse to make the Elven language.
But anyways. And as much as people like those books, I hate them. I mean, they're good books, good story, great world, but actually reading the books, they're just so dense with stuff that you don't give a shit about.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Like, they're a chore to get through. I mean, people are going to hate me for saying that, but it's
as
true.
As soon as they leave the Shire, like, once they're like, all right, bye, Tom Bombadil, bye, Barrow White.
It's like reading a history textbook.
I lose all interest. I lose all interest past that point. Because when he's doing the textbook shit in the Shire, it's interesting because it's like, oh, they eat these foods. I'm like, oh, I love food. Or, oh, they have this festival, smoking this tobacco. And I'm like, oh, all right, this is good.
Smoke weed.
Yeah.
Smoke weed every day.
They're doing this whole thing. And I'm like, all right, this is interesting. I like where this is going. And then once they leave, they're like, and then the dwarves, and they dug too deep.
Yeah, like, and he spends, three pages listing the names of characters that nobody's ever going to talk about again. It's just like, all right.
That is too much lore. Too much lore. I mean, it's good to have that lore for yourself, but you
know. He was kind of like the first one to do it, so I mean, I can't really hate on him too bad, but I mean, it's a chore to read, and we'll leave it at that. Speaking of Tolkien, I want to talk about some cliche things in terms of races. And I'm not talking about, like, you know, who can get to the finish line. I'm talking about elves, dwarves, you know, dryads, although you don't see those guys as much. But these kind of races, orcs, they're in pretty much everything with fantasy. And of course, they started with Tolkien. And they're just such a staple of fantasy that it's hard to imagine a lot of fantasy worlds without them. But it's entirely possible to avoid them altogether. I mean, look at Game of Thrones.
They don't have
dragons and stuff, but they don't have, like, you know, they have dragons, but they don't have elves or dwarves. They're all humans.
They do have, like, fantasy races, but they're not the cliche ones. Like, they've got the White Walkers.
Those are more like ghosts, though. They're not, like...
Yeah, no, but I'm saying they are fantastical creatures. They are the
They're creatures, but they're not a race.
They're the orcs of Game of Thrones. In my opinion, they're the orcs. They're that opposing dark force that you're fighting.
Aren't they monsters more than an actual race? Like, they don't have, like, a village in the woods somewhere.
Orcs are monsters. They're not humanities. Nah.
You know,
for the horde.
That's racist, good sir.
Yes, fantasy racist.
But
just a disclaimer, I love playing orcs. So, it's... I'm not actually racist.
The idea that I want to say here is that it's not necessarily bad to include them, but if you do make them yours,
yes.
In a lot of my stories or worlds that I have, I don't use those races, but I'll come up with my own races that are based on those archetypes. For example, there was one world that I had, and instead of elves, there were flying snake people based on Coatl Aztec gods, the feathered snakes, and it was based more on Mayan and Aztec mythology, and they lived in the woods, but they had the same kind of archetype as the elves, in that they were, you know, the wood people, the magic people. But yeah. I built the culture in a different way, because they were snakes and they could fly, and it was completely different, but at the same time it was familiar, because it was based on the cliche elf race that people are familiar with. So there's there's nothing wrong with including the races in a more general way, but if you can really change them, I mean, you don't have to change it as drastically as my example. I mean, you can still call them elves or what have you, but if you're able to make the culture, and that's the important word here, culture, if you can really tailor it to the world of your game, it will feel like they fit so much more, and it will bring your world to life a lot more than just, you know, elves. They have, you know, spiky ears and they live in the woods.
Yeah.
I also want to add, you don't have to actually use a race. It's not mandatory. My game has no races in it. You add it in if it fits your game and culture, basically.
Yeah. What I find interesting as far as the whole orc versus elf thing is, when Norse mythology, I don't think there are any orcs, but elves in Norse mythology are pretty much what orcs are. They're or goblins in like Tolkien-esque thing. They're basically these cave-dwelling ugly creatures that, when exposed to sunlight, they experience pain.
Yeah, modern elves only showed up after Lord of the Rings, way that we're mostly people familiar with.
Interesting.
And as far as races go, I want to address the elephant in the room, something that's widely discussed in the RPG Maker forums, as far as, and to use Game of Thrones as a reference as well. When addressing people of different skin tones, some people will get up in arms about, oh, why aren't there any dark-skinned characters in the game? And there can be dark-skinned characters in the game, but they don't exactly have to be African-American, whereas you've got the Dornish in Game of Thrones, which there are the dark-skinned people, and they're pretty much, they're Dornish. They're Dornish. They're not African. They're Dornish. And then you've got people wherever Daenerys is running around.
Dothraki.
I forget what it's. Yeah, no, not the Dothraki.
Oh, the desert people?
Yeah, the desert people. I forget what that town's called.
Yeah, but it's like based on Persia.
Yeah, they got stuff like that, where you can base it on real-world locations, but they would be a different name entirely. So, I mean, it's good to have exotic cultures and to have something that's not just the white Nordic male template. But at the same time, they don't have to don't throw in a character that is African-American, I'm from Detroit, when you don't have anything resembling Detroit in your story. Or don't throw in somebody who is stereotypically Mexican when you don't have any type of Mexico-related culture in your story. I mean, if you've got, or, you know, even Asia. If you don't have an Asian town, don't throw in your generic Asia guy.
And don't make an Asian town either. Make, like, an Asian country or a nation or a continent across the sea.
Exactly.
You can't just have, like, one town. Like, Final Fantasy VII did this, right? There was one town with Chinese people, and it was like, what? Where did that come from?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, this doesn't match anything else. It's not even, like, a nation. It was just one town.
No, it was on a different continent.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I've got in my game is – it's not in my game, but it's part of the whole world lore is, you know, I've got just these islands in the west, and that's my Asia group right there is just – in this network of islands. And for that, they don't even look particularly Asian. It's mostly for the architecture and oddly colored hair, like green and silver and shit. They're kind of like my half-elves / half-Asian type stuff. But at the same thing, it's, you know, it's an actual country dedicated to it, not just, you know, oh, it's the one town, welcome to Wutai. What else you got, Despain, as far as cliches?
Well, I talked a little bit about the 14-year-old hero before, and now I want to talk about the other hero that's in every RPG Maker game that you find.
Tips.
And that's the busty, cute, you know, demure healer girl who, you know, she's soft and sweet and you fall in love with her.
Eris.
But she also has a rough side. Killam knows the word for that.
Tissandre. Huh? No, Tissandres aren't cute. Tissandres are, like, angry.
They're cute once in a while. They're not cute all the time.
Exactly.
They're angry all the time.
There are two types. There's type B and type A.
Generic female healer. She's gotta go.
Why? I don't know. I like characters like that.
Well,
your waifu is one of them.
Yeah.
No, she isn't. My waifu is a type B Tissandre, which are actually rare. So fuck off.
No, we're talking about generic female healers. So, it's basically...
Why do girls always have to heal? Why can't a dude be a healer, you know?
Because they
may make a girl
a
barbarian.
Use a sword.
Well, I've got a healer in my game that's a girl, but she's a paladin, so she's the healer, but she also can tank and do damage. So I give her versatility, and she's like badass swordsman chick who can heal. It's not so much I want to save people; it's just more like it's my duty to keep people going.
I think barbarian chicks can be pretty hot. I mean,
yeah,
only see two kinds of women in RPGs. There's the healer, or there's like you know the seductress ninja woman, right? And there are so many different archetypes for male characters, but there's only seem to be a few for women. And why not just spread out the archetypes and share the love? I mean, there's no reason a tattooed tribal warrior can't have tits.
Yeah, I don't really view the archetype. Personally, I don't really view them by gender. I don't go, oh, well, men have all this and women have all this.
Exactly.
I just go if the gender fits the situation. Like, honestly, I just try and keep my gen, like when I do a huge cast, which I haven't made a game with a huge cast yet, but when I design huge casts of characters, I try and keep the genders at least somewhat balanced. Just go, all right, well, I've got 8 guys and 4 girls. Let me switch 2 of these to women.
And I don't think that way at all. I don't artificially try to balance my
No, it's not artificial. Casts. It's more of I view characters as the gender doesn't matter. I can change the characters, I can swap their gender, and their core personality will still match.
That only works up to a point, though, because a person's gender will tremendously have an impact on their personality, especially if you look at the way their culture works and how they were raised within that culture.
Well, yeah, when you get to the final implementation stage.
Yeah, when you actually get into
when
it.
You're designing a cast, when you're just getting a rough – all right, I want this archer or I want this healer and I want this swordsman or I want this. And then you're like, all right, I've got all the gameplay elements I want. All right, well, let me assign some genders. All right, well, I want 4 guys and 4 girls. All right, that's cool. And now let's go into personalities and fine-tune it and make it so the gender fits and whatnot. But it's more of I want to keep a balanced cast of gendered characters – just so there's more of a variety for people to work with. I don't want there to be too many girls and I don't want there to be too many guys. That way, you know, if somebody wants a group of all girls, they can have all girls. If they want to mix and match, they can mix and match. If they want to cast of all guys, they can have all guys. I mean, I like to keep it balanced so there's a lot of options for the player to use. So whatever type of makeup you prefer, I want there to at least be an option. I mean, honestly, with my first game, I've just got the strict 1 girl, 3 guys type thing because I'm making a core game. I want to get it done fast, and I don't have an option for a huge, wild cast of characters. But hopefully, as I get my game design skills fine tuned, I can add to that. But you know, I do prefer in some games where I have a wide option of characters to choose from, so I can mix and match for my own while they're all equally viable. Let's move on to our final thoughts. Killam, what are your final thoughts about this whole cliche topic?
Well, I like what you said about the whole personalization thing in the beginning. Personalize your cliche to fit your game. That makes it special, and that takes away from the whole cliche aspect. Give your cliche that originality back.
That meaning.
Yeah, exactly. You can do it through intensive lore planning. You can do it through intensive character development. You can use cliches. And there's nothing wrong with it, but just make sure they're executed correctly. That's really just put effort into it, basically.
Give your cliches intensive care. Despin, what are your thoughts?
Well, the biggest thing that I would suggest is don't even think about them. Don't worry about them. Don't try to avoid them. Don't try to include them. Pretend they're not really a thing and just focus on your story and making your story the best it can possibly be. If you put the idea of cliches completely out of your mind, there's a higher chance that your story will be working within itself. And I always stress it, it's always my thesis at the end of the podcast, is you really want your game to be a singular whole experience with its own identity. And so yes. Forget about the cliches, don't forget about everything we've said here. But don't actively work towards one thing or another. Don't say, this is a cliche, I have to avoid it. Just do what's best for your story. And I think that's what I would want everybody to take away from this.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that point you said, where don't try and include cliches as well. Like, don't go, oh, well, I'm doing this RPG, I have to have this. Or don't – like, I've seen a few topics where people will have a list of characters, and then a couple characters will just be empty, and they'll go, oh, well, I needed this female healer. It's no, if it's not part of the core experience, scrap it. Don't include things that are cliches or that are characteristic of RPGs just because. Don't include, oh, I have to have item mixing. I have to have mounts. I have to have quests. Don't throw it in if it doesn't fit the gameplay, if it doesn't fit the story. Keep it like my co-hosts have mentioned, make it so it's cohesive. Make it so it fits. Make it so whatever you're putting together, like Despain said, don't even think of them as cliches. If what you're including fits with the story and adds to a cohesive flow of gameplay and storytelling, stick with it. So if you've got your character with amnesia, if it fits the story and I'm not sitting there going, fuck, another amnesia character, that's fine. Go with it. Just make sure it makes sense. So with that, those are our final thoughts. Let's move on to last week's question. Lots of people mentioned the expected for what our last question was, which was basically what type of games influenced you. So one of those expected games where people were inspired by Final Fantasy, Legend of Zelda, Phantasy Star, Chrono Trigger, and you know various others that you would probably think of. But some of the games that stood out that weren't expected were games like Suikitsune, Knights, and how the whole experience of the game captured the magical feel of a dream world, not safety. Dream world. Another game was Not Safety.
A person was Not Safety, who talked about...
A person was Not Safety? Likes, okay.
He so, likes shooting games, shmups, yeah, shmups. You know, space fighters, fighting games.
Yeah, the Dodonpachi games that he mentioned I love a lot, too. They have a lot of emphasis on music, too. I wanted to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, there are these action games that a lot of people might not necessarily associate with when you're talking about RPGs, but you can really get a lesson from every type of game if you enjoy the gameplay, if you can figure out what works and what you like about it, and you can try to bring that over. And he talks about specifically risk versus reward and how he looks at other games in other genres and how they implement that kind of idea and how he can pull it into his own RPG-style gameplay in his own game. And I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, and on FinalBossBlues.com, Sindane made a great point where they said, really, any source of entertainment that I can build my story writing skills with, I would use as an inspiration. So they go beyond the just video games. They include movies and books and even music, I would imagine.
Yeah, I talk about that all the time. I talk about The Wire, yeah. I talk about Magic the Gathering. And
yeah,
it's,
Game
I
of
mean,
Thrones.
When you're working on anything creative, be it a game or you're writing a book or a screenplay or you're drawing a picture or something, just pull sources from everywhere. Everything you do, every time you read something or watch something, just absorb as much as you can, and it'll affect you and give you a sharper outlook on creating things of your own.
The more you expose yourself to entertainment, the more you have to draw from when you make your own. So
exactly.
Broaden your horizons. Try and experience as much as you can. So for this week's question of the week, and while last one's was question of the month, this one will hopefully be question of the week. What are your thoughts on cliches? You think they're good? Do you think they're bad? How do you think they can work? Is there a specific cliche that you avoid or ones that you like to include? That's this week's question. Let us know what you think about cliches. And this week we have something special to include in our episode. And a listener by the name of Sean on FinalBossBlues.com asked us this question. They asked, how do you guys feel about 2D graphics with an orchestrated soundtrack? And I think unanimously we all agreed that that's a good thing, one that can be used well. What do you guys think?
I think it works if the 2D graphics fit. For example, you know, if they're painted and if they're really well made, it can work.
Symphony of the Night.
Sure. It can also work, I mean, if you have the whole 8-bit style going on with an orchestrated soundtrack, it can be a little jarring, but that's not to say it won't work. It could. It depends on the game, of course. I mean, sometimes if your game is 8-bit graphics, you really want to go with the chiptune kind of feel just to make it feel like a more cohesive experience. But, I mean, if the music's good, if it's really good, then people aren't going to give you a hard time about it.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as it's consistent within itself, I would say.
Yeah.
I kind of agree. For me, music is like one of the most important parts of the game, so my opinion is a little more detailed. The plane, as in the 2D versus 3D plane, that isn't really that doesn't matter. What matters is the bit, or the 32-bit, the 16-bit, 8-bit, whatever it is. That plays a better, bigger role in your soundtrack. I tried in my game, I'm doing 16-bit, like the earlier SNES games, and I really, really tried to include orchestrated soundtracks and the like, but it just really didn't fit with the graphic aesthetics, so we had to move away from that, and we had to use SNES sound fonts. But again, if you have the graphics up to par, the 32-bit or higher, whatever you want to use, then yes, I would definitely agree with that, since most RPG soundtracks now are film score and orchestrated anyway.
Yeah, like if you're doing a not nostalgic 2D game where you're trying to use the utmost 2D that you can, like hand-drawn art or painted, as Despain said, then orchestrated could work perfectly for that. Especially, it's just the orchestrated music you're using should fit with the situation, obviously. I mean, I've been playing Ni No Kuni, and yes, it's a 3D game, but oh my god, the soundtrack in that. It's pretty much all orchestrated. It's not what I usually like in RPGs, where it's all Final Fantasy high-tempo type stuff. The entire thing is orchestrated, but it all fits. It fits majestic. It feels tense at the right moments. So,
well, that's because it's Joe Hisaishi and the Tokyo Philharmonic Orchestra. They're,
oh my god, it's so beautiful. but yeah. No. Yeah, it's well done, but it's a way to show that orchestrated music can work. You just want to make sure that when you're using it with 2D graphics, you'll want the type of art that you're using to fit that orchestrated feel. So you'll definitely want something very, very painterly or smooth edges with your pixel art. You'll want to have something that feels kind of majestic, I guess. When I think of orchestrated music, I think of something that's a bit more classical or majestic or just, you know. Yeah. You wouldn't want to have like a Mega Man type game with orchestrated music. It just wouldn't fit. So it depends on your pacing. There's a lot of elements to consider with it. So it can work. You just have to put a lot of effort into it to make sure it fits.
Hey, Killam, what do you think about people who turn off the music and they listen to their own music while playing games? You have no idea.
No, one of my best friends does that. I literally cannot even, like, I'm like, what, why are you doing that? I get so pissed off. I tell him, and he watches TV while playing games too. I'm like, what the hell are you doing? I tell him to stop, turn the TV off, play the game like it's supposed to be played. I can't, no. I hate that so much.
I agree, it's terrible, except for MMOs. When I'm playing an MMO, well, I don't play them anymore, but when I did, when I played MMOs, the first week or two, I would use the in-game music and be like, all right, this is good. But after a bit, I'd be like, I gotta listen to my own music.
Well, that's because MMOs don't really have a good soundtrack most of the time.
Yeah, they
don't. It's forgettable.
Yeah, it is very forgettable. Some of them are good. Like, World of Warcraft, some areas had really good soundtrack. Like, Thunder Bluff, I love that song. I love the song to Thunder Bluff because it's very tribal. I like tribal music. It's very good. But yeah, no, I'm with Killam on this one. Play the game with the intended soundtrack. Don't play your own goddamn music. Have some respect.
Yeah, exactly. Please, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the question, Sean. It looks like we're about ready to wrap things up here. I want to thank you all. I mean, we missed 2 weeks. We were busy with other things, but it looks like we're back on schedule now. This has been episode 11, right?
Yep.
All right, 11. I am Despain.
Raynard Frost.
And this is Killam.
And as always, you can hit us up on the finalbossblues.com website. Or Twitter at Final Boss Blues or at Rannard Frost, right?
Yep.
Or as always, you can reply in the podcast thread on forums.rpgmakerweb.com. Thank you all for listening. See you next week.
Adios. Farted. All right, anyways.